Hello and welcome to the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. If we haven't met yet, then my name is Claire. I'm a registered nutritionist and I specialize in PCOS because I have it too. And I know how frustrating the symptoms can be, but I also know what it's like when you finally figure it out and how those symptoms don't actually play as much of a role in your life anymore. Now, as well as being a nutritionist, I have a background in exercise science and also natural fertility education and functional medicine, which is about really, so I'm not a doctor by any stretch, but that really a functional approach means trying to ascertain what's driving this hormonal imbalance, especially in chronic conditions like PCOS. And PCOS is what they would term a chronic condition. It's one of those things kind of like type 2 diabetes, that it's a combination of our genetics not interacting or playing nicely with our environment. And while we can't change our genetics, we can tweak the way we move and eat and sleep and what nutrients we have in our body, and that can actually help us work with our hormones. And so today on the podcast, I've got the lovely Charlotte, who I met a few months ago when she joined our PCOS protocol program. By a few months, I really mean a few months, like as in last year. But she, one thing that she says in the episode that I think really resonated with me and I think will resonate with you too, is about making PCOS your companion, right? It doesn't mean that you have to be best friends with it, but it's realizing that it's always going to be a constant companion throughout your life. And we, you know, why would we want to fight with that companion our whole life when we can actually sort of make peace and learn to work with that companion? And sometimes things might not go well, we might have little tiffs, but on the whole, if we can have a good relationship with that and work with it, then suddenly it doesn't become such a big issue. And many of the symptoms that we've been struggling with can actually just reduce or even completely resolve. And Charlotte, you'll hear from her story, had many, many symptoms, you know, not just the classic symptoms that you see when you Google PCOS, like hair growth or acne or fertility challenges, but also things that no one really talked about that could be connected to not her necessarily her PCOS, but her underlying root causes that were driving hormonal imbalance. And for her, that was gut health issues and also anxiety as well. And she's found that by balancing her hormones, and not just her sex hormones like estrogen and progesterone and testosterone, but more her blood sugar hormones and her stress hormones, is that actually a lot of those symptoms like the anxiety have in fact resolved a lot. Now, I'm not saying that this is a cure-all for anxiety at all. Anxiety and mental health issues are multifactorial, but I think that it is a good perspective and not one that's spoken a lot about, is that while things like talking therapies for depression, anxiety, medications are all fantastic, sometimes also fixing other underlying issues can also be really, really helpful and effective as well. And I see this clinically in many, many women. And given that it does affect, you know, depression and anxiety do affect a really large proportion of people with PCOS, I think I remember the stat correctly, it's around in the 40% realm, which is massive. Then having, you know, understanding that there are many different ways we can help our mental health, I think is a really important thing to recognize. Now, I won't tell you too much about her story. I'll let her get on and talk to you about that now. So let's welcome Charlotte.
So Charlotte, thank you so much for joining me here. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you again and hear your story and share your story with other women. So thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate that.
So can you start off at the beginning, tell us a bit about your PCOS journey so far?
Sure. So just because when you hear my accent, you probably, you know, guess where I'm from. So just for my background, I was born and raised in Germany. And my mother is French, but my dad's from Vienna. So I kind of, I still grew up with German as my native language. And I right now live in New Zealand, of all places. And we spent the last 5 years in Dublin in Ireland. So my PCOS journey is a very long one because my first symptoms started when I was like 12, 13, when I got my period. But I was actually diagnosed not so long ago, and I'm 39 now. So it really stretches on for a time of over 20 years where I developed different symptoms, and I never really knew how to puzzle them together until, you know, someone mentioned PCOS, and I was like, oh, okay, let's look into that. But it really took a long, long time. So, I would say my first symptom started, when I was like 12 or 13, when I got my period for the first time, and I got it, and then I basically never happened again in a regular way. So I kind of either had like long breaks where nothing happened for like 4, 6, 8 months sometimes, even a year sometimes, or I started to bleed and then I just didn't stop. Like I had continuing bleeding, like spotting for 4 months, 5 months, 6 months.
Wow.
Like it was just a thing that you kind of get used to it. Like it's really like, it wasn't alarming anymore. And I also was quite young, you know, I wasn't like, And every gynecologist that I saw was like, oh, yeah, that's a normal thing. Like, don't worry about just your stress levels or something like that. But when I had my period, it was also quite painful for the first couple of days. But then again, they said it's a normal thing. And being young and being, you know, back then we didn't have, you know, smartphones, or the access to internet was quite tricky. So we didn't have the access to the level of information that we have now. So obviously you believe what your doctor tells you, right? And I remember like maybe after 1 or 2 years after I first had my period, my mom was like, okay, maybe let's just go see a gynecologist for a normal routine checkup. And in Germany, there is like a different health system. So it's rather preventive and focusing on like checkups, while in the Commonwealth or like in Ireland or New Zealand, it's a rather reactive system where you kind of, go to the GP when you think something's wrong, and then they take it from there. But in Germany, like, okay, we do prevention a lot as well.
Mm. Like going to the doctor here and you're like, oh, I'm just here for a checkup. They'd be like, okay. they'd literally just do like blood pressure, cholesterol, like a couple of blood tests, right? And it's like, is this age specific? Like, are you really looking at this for a like 16-year-old girl?
And you always have to fight for everything what you want.
Yes.
And it was the same in Ireland, even though I had even private health insurance in Ireland through my employer, but it was still a struggle, like specialists. And in Germany, you can just call a specialist, like you don't need to go through your GP, you don't need to call them, you get an appointment after a week or 2 weeks, you don't have to wait for 3 or 6 months. Mm. And then you also don't have to pay for anything. Like back then, you didn't have to pay for anything. Now the system has also slightly changed. But so we go to this gynecologist and she does an internal scan and she finds a cyst, and the cyst is quite big, and she's like, okay, we have to like monitor that, come back in 6 months. And so we come back in 6 months, there's another scan, and then she saw that the cyst actually had grown to, I think, almost fist size or something. She's like, okay, we have to take that out because we don't know what it is. And so she refers me to the hospital, and I have I think it's called a laparoscopy, where it's kind of a non-invasive routine surgery where they go in with like 3 little cuts and they blow gas into your belly and then go in with a camera and like a little sizzle thingy, and I'm not really sure, so I apologize.
It's right, and it's exactly what they would do if someone had endometriosis, right? Or to see if they did have endometriosis. So anyone's listening, you might have heard or had a friend or someone that has gone in for this procedure to see if they've got endo.
Yeah, exactly. So they were able to remove everything. However, I was pretty unwell afterwards. Like I was having issues. I was throwing up a lot, and I was fainting a lot as well because I had very high blood pressure, and they weren't really aware of that. And they kind of like, you know, shushed me out of bed every day, and I kind of did 2 steps and fainted. And I had... it was just in my memory. Also, the nurses were not the kindest, and it was just a frightening experience because the whole environment was very strange. I was still a child, and I wasn't really, you know, used to have medical conversations with like doctors and stuff without my parents around. So yeah, it was just not the best memory of the whole thing. And then every gynecologist that I saw later on over the years for those routine checkups, it was always kind of in hindsight of that cyst. So when they started to mention, oh yeah, there are small cysts around your ovaries, I always connected that to this kind of, you know, cyst incident.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of were like, yeah, you just have the tendency to grow cysts and we just need to, you know, be aware that it's not dangerous, don't worry about it. You just need to be aware that, or you just have to monitor them, like come back in like 6 months or 12 months and we just have a look at them so they don't grow. So that was kind of the only thing, but there was never any mention of, it could be something else, it could be PCOS, it could be relatable to hormones or anything. It was always just this one thing and they always brushed it off.
Mm-hmm.
And what they also, every time I saw a gynecologist, was always kind of the main message was, there was nothing they can do or nothing I can do to regulate my period unless I take the pill, the contraceptive pill, which I didn't want to take. So and they said the only reason why I don't get my period is because I'm stressed. So it's kind of like a mental thing. It's my own, like they didn't say it's my own fault, but you know, that kind of manifested after a while, after hearing it for such and such many times, like you kind of start to think, wow, that's really, it's you, like you're responsible that your body is not doing what it's supposed to do. And all my friends around me were like, you know, yeah, no, they're having a period in a normal way and each month in the normal cycle. And I was just like, why am I so different? Why is this not working? And yeah, and you start to make yourself responsible for it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously that didn't happen immediately, but it kind of happened over a long period of time that I developed this mindset.
Yeah, and you internalize it. It's the same when people say, you know, different in a different circumstance, but when they go to the doctor and the doctor says, oh, well, you know, there's nothing you can do. You just need to go away and lose weight. You know, you then make the connection and you say, well, the reason I'm getting these symptoms is because of my weight. Because they're saying, well, if I lose the weight, then the symptoms will get better. And when you've been told your whole life that weight is just a function of how much you eat and how much you exercise, then you think, well, okay, I've caused these symptoms because I'm either eating too much or exercising too little. And that's not, it's not true, right? It's the same thing as the way that you internalized it. And it possibly wasn't even true for the start, right? Like,
yeah,
that's the thing is like, okay, so you've plucked this thing out of the air by just looking at me and saying, oh, well, you're a schoolgirl, so you must be stressed because of exams. Right, like I bet there was no test done, there was no cortisol, there was no stress hormone testing, it was
nothing.
Plucked out of the air.
Yeah, absolutely nothing. And then also back then, you know, like you're 15, 16, 17, you're still in high school, there's not so much to be stressed about. Like I was just a normal teenager. I mean, there was nothing major going on in my life that would have just stressed me out so much. I mean, obviously puberty and being a teenager is stressful enough, but not in a way that would impact your bodily function so much.
Yeah. And it's like, well, if that was true, then none of my friends would have their periods either.
Exactly. So yeah, but as I mentioned before, back then we didn't have the access to information and knowledge as, you know, as like now, like where we had just, you know, it's always like just the Google away or just the attention function away where you like get access to information. I mean, there's also so much misinformation out there. So you have to be, it is very complicated to make a kind of, you know, informed decision as a consumer nowadays as well. But back then we didn't have that option at all. Oh, it was just very tricky. Like sometimes I remember like you had to go to the library and find books about
this
specific topic. and then another symptom that I developed a bit later on, I think I was in my early 20s. I think I mentioned that before, that I started to get developed hirsutism, but only on my jawline, and it wasn't very significant. Like it was just like starting to get like thick hairs now and then, which was really annoying. Like I remember it was like, you know, like on long road trips and just like playing with them, and I was just like, what is that and why is it there? And it just really started to annoy me a lot, and I started to pluck them, which was a bad idea obviously, because then, you know, they grow back and thicker, and it just was really, it was an annoying thing that also made me quite insecure over the years. And my skin around my neck also really suffered because I have really sensitive skin. And my skin didn't like that at all, to just, you know, pluck all the time. And it was, I was also not in a state where I was like, okay, right, I go to a dermatologist. Like, I didn't really have that mindset on to be like, yep, I confront myself with these issues. I was rather in the ignoring mindset,
yeah,
for many, many years. I never suffered from, fortunately, was like other skin problems. Like, I never had acne throughout puberty or later on at all. I never had pimples. And so the only thing that I developed much later on in my 30s was that I got like sometimes rashes and like dermatitis, or like really dry patches in my face. And they were always connectable with situations where I was kind of stressed of social events, like when we had big work events, or when we had like there was like a social thing, like a wedding. Because I'm a rather shy person, or like a rather introvert, like I don't really enjoy being, you know, out with lots of people that I don't know. So I think that was to be connected with that. So I'm not really sure if you can connect that with PCOS, since I never had the acne symptom itself. But another symptom, and you kind of touched it already, was the weight that I suffered from. But it wasn't like a major, I was never overweight in that sense. I mean, back then we used BMI, even though now we know it's kind of, you know, highly controversial. I was always kind of in the normal range, and I was never overweight. And doctors never told me at any time that I had to lose weight. But I was always kind of the chubby one. I was always like chubbier than my sister, even though we kind of grew up with the same food. And my mom, you know, French, being like an amazing cook, and we always had like fresh food. There was nothing processed in our household. There was not too much sugar. We didn't have, you know, soft drinks or anything. We grew up in a very healthy and nutritional way. So, but we're also not very active. We weren't like a family that, you know, go out every weekend and a sport. We were more like, you know, walking the dog or going hiking now and then, like up on the mountain. But it wasn't like, that was kind of the max what we did. But since, you know, my sister and I kind of grew up the same way, and she was super skinny and I was always the chubby one, so my chubbiness was always kind of a topic. But that was kind of the only thing. Like, I never really had proper symptoms. It was more like I got cravings. Like, sometimes I really craved sugar. It sneaked into the kitchen and stuff like that. But later on, when I already moved out, I was always like, I was flatting with my friends for many, many years throughout, like the end of high school, through uni. We were like always living with my best friends. And then you also have this comparison, what they eat, what you eat. And obviously as students, you kind of have the same not so healthy diet with like lots of pasta and lots of rice and lots of cheese bread. Like in Germany, you have lots of bread with cheese all the time.
Yeah. In New Zealand, you have lots of 2-minute noodles.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, really, anyone else in the world, I don't know if you guys have these, but they're like basically fried noodles that you can just put into water and put in the microwave for 2 minutes. And then they have these like, it's Asian. New Zealand is very Asian influenced because we're at the bottom of the world. And, you know, anyway, so you put these like seasoned packets on, and they're like, what, I don't know, 50 cents a packet or something like that. And that's pretty much all college or university students live off those.
Yeah, I recently had a craving for that as well.
I love it how you like that. I've really like stooped far from my French upbringing to like New Zealand 2-minute noodles.
Don't tell my mom.
Yeah, your mom would be horrified.
What have you done?
Yeah. Sorry, guys, you're going to have to put up with that siren that's going on outside. urban traffic, urban noise.
Yeah, we don't have that here in the rural nothingness where I live in New Zealand.
Yeah, that is very true.
We just have some mooing cows. And sheep. Yeah.
Some hungry lambs outside your window waiting to be fed.
Exactly. I think once I was living with my friends and we started having, you know, like different food than I was having at home, my symptoms really started to show. Like, I got a really, like, I always had a belly, and it kind of, I started to eat something and it was just blowing up like a balloon. It was incredible. And it got also really hard and really uncomfortable. And so that was one thing that was really like continuously I was suffering from. But it was also such a weird thing that happened. Like, I remember I was making jokes about my belly, how I look like, you know, I was pregnant. Another thing that happened was that I was sometimes constipated for a long time, or I had like diarrhea in phases. So that was really, it was kind of coming and going in phases. Sometimes it was rather normal, but then I had this kind of like weird extreme phases. Another thing that happened was I got really gassy sometimes, like after and I could never pin down which food it was. Like, it seemed to be so random and really uncomfortable. Something else that I noticed back then really significantly was my energy levels, that I had increasing fatigue and increasing like brain fog after certain foods.
Yeah.
And that I also got really low energy levels after food that my friends didn't have at all. Like, we had the same dinner and they were like, right, let's go to the pub, let's have a beer. And I was just like, I don't understand how you're doing that. I can hardly like stand up and you know, I feel like I'm literally fall asleep on the table. And I was, you know, staying at home a lot, sleeping, but I was also kind of forcing myself to go out. But then I had a beer, and then I was like, right, I have to go to bed now because I can't stay awake. I mean, obviously in Bavaria you have also lots of beer when you go out, and beer was always my, like, it's kind of like a knockout drink for me. It's like, you know, this sweet and sugary thing. But I didn't know it back then that it has, I was just, it never realized how people can drink 5 beer and then still go and party on. And like, I would just sleep in the bar. So yeah, that was interesting that time.
So for you, the fatigue was mostly after food.
Yes.
Definitely. Was it also when you woke up in the morning? Were you kind of there?
That too, but there was a different feeling of more tiredness and sluggishness. And
yeah, right.
That it was really like kind of foggy head, but
yeah,
it was like really hard to be like, you know, this moment where you're kind of wake up and you're still a bit drowsy, and then sometimes you're like full of energy and you're like, get up, man, no problem. And then, but I was like, no, I just have to turn around and sleep and doze and snooze for like another hour or 2 hours because I just couldn't get up. I was like literally physically unable to do this. And it was it was a struggle. I mean, that was a struggle as well as the whole nutritional thing, because I kind of grew up with this, like, okay, I'm a bit more chubby, but I was okay, you know, I wasn't like really suffering from it. But then I developed the symptoms, I developed the energy issue, and then I was traveling quite a bit as well. I went to South America and Southeast Asia for several times, and there it happened to me a lot that women actually on the street approached me and were like, oh, you're pregnant, that's lovely, how far along are you? And I was just like, whoa, okay, this is not just something. Because, you know, in Germany, people don't really make...
No, I would never.
Unless you're friends, obviously, or you ask a stranger for the way, but you're not really going up, you know, I'm not really walking up to someone and be like, oh, you're pregnant, that's nice. So that really got me thinking, and it made me doubting my body image much more than before. And so I started to focus on food more and more, and I got really upset and really frustrated with my body. And then because of this, but also because of some ethical reasons, I became a vegetarian, and then I had phases of being plant-based, and then I had phases of being pescatarian and flexitarian. So I was always searching for the way how to eat in a good and healthy way, but also that is kind of benefiting me, and it helped me to lose weight. So I ditched wheat and dairy quite early on. I think I must be under 20 where, you know, I stopped drinking milk and stuff like that. Just because I found a book that had information about that, not because it wasn't like on the internet or on Instagram. It was like, you know, a book I found in the basement of my parents that was about a specific way of eating, and they had information about wheat and dairy. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. It sounds like reasonable, so I should try that out. So even though I was, you know, within the group of my friends and my flatmates, I was the one who was eating less, like no bread at all and less pasta and all these things. I was still suffering from all these crazy symptoms. And it was also back then hard for me to puzzle it together that it's actually really food connected. I just thought, like I have like zero energy, I'm like tired and I'm sluggish, but I couldn't really pin it down. So it was like, okay, this is because of this food, or this is because of that, what I've done there, and da da da. Because, you know, you're young, you're a student, so much is going on around you, you're not really super self-aware all the time of what you're doing. So
and even when you are, it still can be very random, especially like the IBS, you know, bloating and things like that. And I think this is why a lot of people really struggle with IBS symptoms, that because it doesn't have a specific food trigger.
Exactly. And you can't really puzzle it together. Like so many different things going on, and no one's ever going to tell you, yeah, it's because of this, or it's because of that, or actually there's this thing called IBS.
It's true.
And I don't actually think it was a common knowledge back then that IBS exists.
No, it wasn't. No, when we were going through university, it was not, absolutely not common. You know, it was just starting to be diagnosed, but not with the frequency. I mean, I would say pretty much every one of my friends at uni now would have been diagnosed with IBS had we. And because this is a really interesting thing, it tends to affect females in their early 20s, right? And there is a strong connection there with high estrogen levels and also the hormonal contraceptive pill. So that's why I think that it is so, so, so common in younger females in their 20s to start developing this, especially in, it doesn't sound like it was super common in Germany, but really common in a lot of, you know, New Zealand, Australia, UK, US as well. Yeah, it's very, very, very. And so for you as well, what was the other thing I remember talking to you about was also mood, and that was something that really started to really take its toll during that time too, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if you would probably ask my mom, she would say, yeah, she's always been kind of, you know, like she had her moody faces as a child as well, blah, blah. As a teenager, I was really quite moody, I have to admit that. But it kind of all peaked throughout uni. So, I mean, I was at a stage where I had all these symptoms, right? I had missing periods, I had cysts on my ovaries, I had this hair growth on my chin, and I had this all like this energy and weight issues. But they were all pieces of a puzzle, but I wasn't even aware that this puzzle actually exists, right? That you could actually all connect, that these dots are all connectable. And I was not having the language to explain what was going on. So, and I think probably a reason for that was also that all these symptoms were not, I mean, they were there and they were annoying, but they were all manageable. Like somehow, like, you know, you don't have the mindset to, you're not all the time super aware of them. They kind of like, they go into the background and you live with them, but I was able to live my life without massive restrictions, which is why I think I was not super keen on finding the solution right now on what's going on.
Mm.
That kind of all changed when I started to go to uni, and then obviously my stress levels peaked and all my symptoms started to flare up and my mental health really struggled. So, I think, you know, sluggishness and tiredness, that's something you easily brush off, you know, oh, it's the weather, oh, it's, I don't know, it's the season, it's the moon, it's, I don't know what, it's your period or not period, or it's because we went out so much last night, or, you know, stuff like that, it's your iron level, like you always find something to brush that off easily. But I developed really strong anxiety and panic attacks, especially before lectures. Like I just had really issues to attend my lectures because I was so scared that people would ask me something and I wouldn't know the answer. And like really, you know, like lots of theater in my mind going on about things that could happen, even though, you know, nothing ever happened. It was all good. But I was just getting really anxious. I was really insecure and I had never-ending self-doubts and was really, really confused within this brain fog. Like I couldn't really think clear anymore what's going on and what was my path in front of me. Like I couldn't see that anymore because I was just questioning everything that I did and that I thought and that I said, and it was just really a really tough time. And I had those panic attacks also for public speaking, but I think that just came down, you know, to being rather introvert and rather shy. Like I just hate public speaking. That didn't change. But obviously things get better when you grow older. But I kind of, all these things fed into really low like self-esteem and low self-confidence and on top of that, you deal with the physical symptoms like low energy levels, the moodiness. Yes, we wanted to talk about the moodiness. So yeah, I had days where I was just really sad, really, really sad. Mm. People talking to me were like, what's going on with you? You're so sad. And I'm like, I don't know. I can't tell you. I'm just sad. Or I was really grumpy and angry with myself. Like all these kind of, you know, the physical symptoms plus the mental health symptoms that I developed or that peaked or they came out throughout uni through this phase. I developed an attitude towards myself where I was really, really hard on me. Like I called myself basically stupid all the time for being so irrational and so scared all the time and so incapable of doing normal things. Like, you know, living with my friends, I saw how they were just flying through uni and how they had fun and going to parties and met people, how they went to the gym, how they went to the library, all these normal things. But for me, everything was just such a fight and such a challenge. Not all the time. Like I had phases. Like I had phases where it was stronger or these kind of, you know, brain fog energy, moody, sad faces and confused faces. And then I had faces where I was just, you know, like a normal student girl that had fun and went out with her friends. And so I think that's also a reason there why I wouldn't call myself depressive in that time. Like I wouldn't say that I had a depression. I would rather say I was going through depressive faces.
Yes.
Faces of strong moodiness. Also because I was never medicated for them. I never seek medical help in that sense. Yeah.
It was much more taboo when we were at university, right? Like there was something that was like, whoa, if there was any sort of talk of mental health, it was like, oh, you're a crazy person. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And absolutely. And I still can't understand why that is it was such a thing. Like I always think it would be much easier if you could like teach children in primary school already what it means to be sad and what it means to be jealous and what it means to have negative emotions, because it's so relevant. And all of a sudden you're like within, you know, like being a teenager and growing up and being a student, and you deal with all these emotions and no one tells you what to do. I went to a doctor once, but it was more for my energy and my food issues and the weight gain. And he basically said, okay, I want you to make a food diary for 1 week and then come back to me. So I showed him the food diary after 1 week and he just looks at it for like a second. And then he says, yeah, you're snacking too much. So you should just focus on breakfast, lunch and dinner. And that's it. That was all he did. And I was like, well, okay, that's not helping me at all.
No. And you were like, I was like, for all of the time that I took to complete that damn food diary, and you look at it for 1 second? Oh, my God.
Like eating too much or too many times.
The rage. Who did finally put this together for you then?
Yeah, as I said before, it's a long story.
Oh my goodness.
It's still a little bit away, but by that time, I also just wanted to add that I developed a binge eating disorder as well.
Right, okay.
Going on at uni because of this whole like weight gain, weight loss, energy level. So sometimes, you know, you were actually the first person that gave me that expression, binge eating disorder. I wasn't aware that that is a thing. Mm. And massive aha moment inside for me, because I was like, that is 100% what I was going through at uni for a while. I mean, fortunately not for a long while, but it was a couple of months where it was pretty intense. And I was always thinking I was just having a weird sort of eating disorder that doesn't really fit any tick to any boxes. But yeah, it was absolutely the one that I was suffering from.
And it's so common in PCOS. It's something in the realm, I think this is my right stat, is 25% of women with PCOS. Wow. Have binge eating disorder. Yeah.
And it makes so much sense when you think about
Everything that's going on, not just with like the way we feel about our bodies and the way that we've always been told it's our fault, and so therefore we try all these different things, we're really restrictive, and then we can't keep up with that because it's too restrictive, and then we have these subsequent binges, and then we feel guilty about that and have all this self-loathing, and then leads to more cycles of restricting and then more cycles of binging. But also on top of that, we have these crazy fluctuating hormones, and not just our sex hormones like estrogen and progesterone and testosterone. We have crazy fluctuating blood sugar and the hormone that controls our blood sugar, insulin, and stress hormones as well, which then really exacerbate, because if your blood sugar is really low, it's going to be driving you to binge basically to get your blood sugar back up.
Exactly. And for me, on top of that, it made me even harder to myself. Like I was,
yes.
I was this attitude that I developed towards myself, this like really, you know, unfriendly voice or communication that I was in with myself got just much worse throughout this whole process, because you're like, you can't even lose weight even if you don't eat anything. Look at you, you know.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah, it wasn't really good. It was like a kind of a very vicious cycle I was in. And but then I made it through uni. I survived all of that. And then after that, a phase started where I wasn't so much, you know, focused on all these things. I moved to Berlin. I, you know, you kind of go a bit into this whole party Berlin life, and all this went into the background again. And from there, I got an internship in New York. So that was kind of the same thing. Everything went into the background. And then a while later, I moved to Munich, and it was like the first time in my life I had a regular permanent job, like a real grown-up job. And I had a daily routine, a structure, and I felt all of a sudden I start to feel better. I was like, oh, okay, was maybe that what was missing in my life, that I have to like follow a proper structure and a daily routine. And I did something that finally helped me to get towards a diagnosis. So because I was so annoyed with my, you know, hirsutism around the jawline, I went to a skin therapist that, you know, they do these laser therapies.
Mm-hmm.
So she looks at me and she's like, I'm not sure like if this is genetic or hormonal. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, yeah, because you're so blonde, like you have this very fair skin and you have very blonde hair and you have blue eyes, you look very Scandinavian to me. And usually I treat women that are from Mediterranean countries that have, you know, really dark hair, lots of thick hair, and they have these issues that you know, they have a little bit of, you know, like a woman beard or something like that. So the laser therapy really helps them because it's a genetical thing. But if it's a hormonal thing, I can laser what I want and it's probably not going to help you a lot. And I'm like,
it's just going to grow back, right? If the hormones of the testosterone are still high, exactly. It's like, yeah, we'll kill what's there, but more is just going to sprout up next door.
In a couple of years, it all comes back. And I'm like, what do you mean with hormonal? And she's like, yeah, you can check your hormones. And I'm like, how can I check my hormones? And she's, go to your gynecologist and ask for a blood test. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, light bulb moment. I didn't know about that at all. So I'm going to a gynecologist and I ask for the blood test and she does it. And then a couple of days later, she gives me a call. Like I wasn't even there to speak to her face to face. She gives me a call and she's like, yeah, so it comes back from the lab and it looks like there might be a slight tendency you might have PCOS, but I don't really support that because it's very borderline. And I'm like, what do you mean? What does it even mean, PCOS?
Mm.
And then she goes on, you know, gives me this very medical explanation very fast on the phone, throws out a lot of, you know, medical terms. And I'm like, you know, trying to make notes while I'm on the phone and being like, oh my God, what's going on here? I have no idea what she's talking about. So she's like, okay, so your male hormones are a bit high and your female hormones are a bit low and that can cause irregular periods. And I'm like, okay, but is it dangerous? And she's like, no, it's not dangerous. And I'm like, why do I have it? And she's like, we don't know. It's just there and you can't also cure it. Like there is no cure. And I'm like, okay, so what do we do from here? And she's like, oh, nothing. You just continue, do your thing. But you will probably have issues when you want to have children. Like infertility is a big issue with PCOS. And I'm like, wow, okay.
Mm.
That was really a bomb for me. And then she goes on and she's like, yeah, I just want to come back when you want to have kids. You know, it's probably something that a lot of women with PCOS hear.
I would say 90% of people listening to this would go, yep, that's me. That's exactly what I've been told.
Yeah, and that's exactly what she told me. And then she was like, yeah, because we have like treatments, you can go to like fertility, you know, clinics, and it's going to be quite expensive, but I'm sure there's a way. And I'm like, you know, wow, this is full on. And I was in...
And at this stage, you were what, like early 20s?
Late 20s. I was 28, I think, 28 or 29 by that time. So... I was sitting down after the call, I opened my laptop and I look at, put it into a search engine and put in a PCOS, and then I see in front of me the symptoms, right? I see irregular periods, I see small cysts of follicles on the ovaries, I see hirsutism, I see the inability to lose weight, and I see mood swings and depressive faces, and I was just falling to bits, you know, like on my laptop, just like, I broke down emotionally. Like, you know, when you see those like animated comics when someone turns into a puddle or something or like crumbles.
Yeah.
It was just like, it all came together all of a sudden. And it was all these loose ends were connecting to like one big thing. And I was like, oh my God, like I felt huge relief that it was not me. It was not my fault. I'm not responsible for all this crap happening all the time. I'm not stupid and I'm not, it's not my fault that I'm apparently not woman enough, you know, to menstruate or that I didn't feel like I was fitting in and I was, you know, unable to lose weight and all these things, or growing a beard on my chin.
Yeah.
Or the energy levels, the moodiness, all the digestive issues I was suffering from. So that was a huge relief. And I got really sad as well. Like I was so sad because I was so hard on myself for so many years. And I thought, well, finally I'm finding some language to actually talk about what's happening and what's going on with me. And I was also really shocked about the infertility topic. And the situation back then though was that I was sitting basically on my suitcases because I was going to New Zealand for a year for like a work and travel thing. And I didn't have the headspace or the mindset to basically confront myself with that diagnosis. So I put everything back into, you know, the background in the back of my head and went to New Zealand, had an amazing time. And then I ignored the symptoms that were still there, obviously, until it was almost a year later, I got my period and it was so strong because I haven't had it for such a long time. It was started with incredible cramps that I actually had to go to the emergency. So I ended up in hospital. I hyperventilated because of the pain. I thought I have to breathe deep, but this breathing deep was a bad idea. So I can't, you know, I got a massive panic attack on top of hyperventilating because I got really numb, like my face, my fingers, like I couldn't feel anything. So they were like, yeah, you just need to take ibuprofen, you're fine. So I took a couple of ibuprofens, I was fine, they sent me home, right? But that got me really thinking. I was like, well, I really have to do something about that. Like now is the time to confront yourself. So I started seeing an acupuncture therapist in New Zealand. And then I started to just confront myself way more with, you know, the physical, but also the psychological or the mental side of it. And I decided to I was planning anyway to go back to Europe I had a stopover in India because I wanted to do this yoga teacher training. So the training itself was amazing because everyone was kind of this self-healing journey. I know it's very cheesy and esoterical, but we were in this very special place up in the Himalayas and there were lots of people seeking healing there. There were lots of Ayurvedic people or Ayurvedic clinics there, and people were doing all sorts of, you know, like cleanses. I mean, I was there dominantly to learn yoga and to learn about everything about yoga, but still kind of, you know, it was happening in the background that people really, you know, we talked a lot and there was lots of releasing in a way, you know, through all this yoga, lots of emotional things kind of loosen up because you learn a lot about the manifestation of trauma that you go through, how it kind of sits in your body as well, how you kind of carry a lot of pain in your body without knowing about it. So I developed a more holistic picture of what was happening to me all through all the years and where I'm now and why my body feels the way it does, maybe because of this or maybe because of that. And I remember I also saw a person who did healings, chakra healings, and this person basically had a long talk with me and then they did some sort of like acupressure massage. And again, that was on a point in time where I didn't have my period for like 3, 4, 5 months. So I walked back home to the place where I was staying, and I like on the way there, it already started to flow. Like my period got back again, like really strong, really painful. But again, you know, like something
happened.
And I remembered how like I had some traumatic experiences in like earlier on that kind of connected with the whole like becoming a woman and having a period and all these things. Like it's just it just kind of went, that came together. And I mean, obviously, I still was like, okay, I want to go back to Europe. I want to see doctors because I want to get the medical and the rational side of it as well, and not just the, you know, the very emotional and esoterical way of it.
But I think that that's the amazing two parts of it, right? And that's where, like, you know, the medical side completely ignores any of the other, you know, Eastern kind of medicine in terms of like the Ayurveda and the and also just that that potential emotional component. And I know one of the first books that I read about this was Dr. Christiane Northrup, Woman's Bodies, Woman's Wisdom, I think it is. This is a, basically, it's like a Bible-sized book about different, you know, women's health. And that's one thing that she says about PCOS, is that if there's been some trauma or you've grown up in a very kind of, like tomboy, as like, you know, quite sort of tomboyish, and that whole sort of thing about being a female was, is potentially a little bit traumatic, then that can have some long-lasting effects.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was quite interesting. And yeah, it sounds like that's, you know, that's what you experienced as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Like I connected stories from my past with the present that I was, I didn't see them like for 20 years. I didn't see the connection at all. And all of a sudden I was like, whoa, that makes sense. The dots. And what I also learned during the training was that the whole pelvic area, like the whole, you know, this whole kind of bowl that holds all the feminine organs, and it's actually in like in that, in the Ayurvedic sense, it's very it holds emotions, it holds trauma, it holds the feminine side of things, and not just your own trauma. It can be the trauma of your female ancestor line.
Interesting.
It was really interesting, and we did lots of yin yoga, which is more like the slow and female yoga, where you like do lots of hip openers, like you sometimes stay in a hip opener for like 10 minutes and all the like release you can experience. Like there were people, they were crying, they were bawling out their eyes, and you know, during the yin yoga classes, because there was so much stuff coming up, and you have to like, you know, you face it and you deal with it, and, you know, you go out of it and it's much better. Anyway, so I go back to Germany and I go back to this gynecologist, right? But she wasn't there, so I saw a different gynecologist. But and he looks at me and he does this checkup, and he's like, he looks at the old blood picture, the blood results, and he's like, I don't support that. You don't have PCOS. And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like, and he's like, yeah, you know, it really comes down at what point in your cycle you were when these blood tests were done. So maybe you were just like in a situation where this and this was happening, and I don't think you have PCOS, you're going to be fine. That was it. And I was like, wow, that is intense. And I don't know. I mean, by that time, I was again in a situation where I was with my partner, now husband, father of my child. We were like, you know, we were on the move to Ireland. And so it was kind of again moving into the background, even though I was like coming back from Asia. I was like, right, I'm gonna, you know, confront myself now with everything. But then we would go to Ireland. Everything's exciting, you know. There was new job, new friends, everything, and. I'm still suffering from my symptoms, and low energy levels come back, bloatedness comes back, the food issues come back, missing periods. I'm still having quite dark days in terms of mental health, but not always, like much better than before. You know, it wasn't phases, it was like an afternoon sometimes. And I realized these afternoons were mostly when we, you know, it was like a Sunday afternoon, and I saw lots of like families with kids and stuff, and that made me think, oh, maybe it's time, you know, maybe we should start about thinking having a family. So we started trying to conceive, obviously didn't work. And then I was
Were you getting a regular period at this stage?
Absolutely not. I had no clue. I was taking my temperature in the mornings, and it was just all over the place. It didn't help me at all. And I was trying to be, you know, quite compliant about food, like cutting out dairy, cutting out wheat. But then because I wasn't eating a lot of animal protein, I wasn't. And I also didn't eat any eggs because I didn't like the taste of eggs. I wasn't in a good physical place, I think.
Yeah.
So I, we said, let's
go ahead.
We ended up in a fertility clinic, and that was actually like, you know, the first time someone looks at me and says, of course you have PCOS. Like, was the nurse who was supposed to do the internal scan, and she asks me before doing the scan, she asked me, when was your last period? And I'm like, I actually can't remember. It's like a long time ago. It's very irregular. And then she's like, oh, you probably have PCOS. And I'm like, oh, okay. That came out easily. So why is this different in Ireland and in Germany? Yeah. And yeah, and then we talk, we have a consultation with the doctor, and he's like, yep, you have PCOS. And yeah, you're not the youngest anymore. I was, I don't know, 35 by then. You should do IVF. And here's metformin, dexamethasone. And I'm like, whoa, okay. Pretty shocked about the IVF thing, because I thought, I have a hormonal disbalance. Why is there no hormonal
medication?
Why do you have to like send me all the way through through IVF? Because, and I, back then I didn't really understand what it was anyway, like, you know, the full context of it. So after months and months of prep work and discussions, we said, okay, I'm going to Czech Republic to do IVF, because it was not affordable for us in Ireland. Mm. And then it failed, like the IVF cycle failed, because I developed ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome,
which
is also a very, it's a quite common thing for women with PCOS, because you have so many follicles on your ovaries. So once you kind of stimulate them, they just blow up like balloons. And yeah, so we decided to go for a frozen transfer. And that frozen transfer also failed, because I don't know, I think I ovulated too early. They couldn't really tell me what happened, but they did a scan and they said, no, it's not good. You can't go ahead. So you have to wait another cycle. And by that time, a month later, I found out I was pregnant. And then they were like, yeah.
Wow.
That's not uncommon, because you have all these hormones in your body and they kind of have a long-term effect. So actually a failed IVF always, very often results in a pregnancy. And I'm like, okay, so when this is such a common knowledge, why didn't you tell me? Anyway, I lost the pregnancy, unfortunately. And then I had a miscarriage. And then shortly after, I actually fell pregnant again. And again, they were like kind of, you know, patronizing, being like, oh, yeah, you're always super fertile after a miscarriage. And I'm like, wow, you're not helping me here at all. Like, I was all over the place, like emotionally from in a very dark, dark place because of the miscarriage, to being very, very scared and confused and careful about the new pregnancy, because, you know, I was just scared that, you know, I might miscarry again. Fortunately, everything went well. I had a really good pregnancy and a very good, uncomplicated home birth in our very tiny apartment in Dublin. And then we ended up in New Zealand, and in New Zealand with a very young baby, I realized, wow, symptoms are coming back, surprise, even though I thought my symptoms might regulate themselves after being pregnant. I don't know why I thought, but it's actually not the case at all.
No, a lot of people do, because they think, oh, it's a female hormonal condition. So if I start, you know, if I get pregnant, that might kickstart things. But if we look at actually what's going on, which is, okay, often blood sugar and insulin's too high, stress hormones are too high, that stuff gets worse. Like insulin gets worse during pregnancy. And this is why I get so many women messaging me on Instagram being like, does PCOS get better after pregnancy? I'm like, no, in most cases it gets worse, right? Like you might feel better during pregnancy, but then, and I think this leads people into a bit of a false sense of security, and then those symptoms come back with a vengeance. 100%
agree. I remember my friends telling me, yeah, you might gain some weight during pregnancy, but then you start breastfeeding and everything's going to be, you know, it's just going to be like the kilos will drop from you. And I'm like, I was the complete opposite. I almost didn't gain anything throughout pregnancy. I was quite active, did lots of yoga, cycling, walking. I probably gained 4 kilos. Like it wasn't, I mean, not during pregnancy, obviously I gained more, but afterwards, you know, after birth, it was probably 4 kilos in the end. But then starting to breastfeed, I had this breastfeeding issue, like I didn't have enough milk. And I was told again, that could be a PCOS symptom.
Yeah, which no one tells you during pregnancy. It's like, well, if we knew this, we could get you onto a lactation specialist, like during, you know, to prepare you. But
by the end of the pregnancy, I met, like when I met my midwife, when I decided to go private with a home birth, she was fantastic. And she said, okay, we should, you know, now, and she was also a lactation specialist and she helped me through the whole ordeal, but it was really challenging. That thing after, like the whole breastfeeding thing after, was probably more challenging than the whole pregnancy.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's a common thing.
And what was so challenging as well was my my eating completely got all over the place. Like I had cravings the whole time. I didn't know what to eat. I was like hyper, and then I was down, and I was really all over the place. And for me, the whole craving and binge eating, and it all came back during this breastfeeding time. And by the time I arrived in New Zealand and we kind of settled here more or less, I also started to become very moody again and had my digestive problems again. Like I was very gassy, very bloated, low energy. I sometimes fell asleep in the afternoon while my baby was there, and I was like, this is dangerous. I don't want that. And I don't want to be this person. And during long walks with him, I actually found your podcast. And that was such a big aha moment. And I was absolutely blown away by the information. I'm blown away by how accessible it is, how understandable it is, how you share your knowledge. And it's, it was every time was some sort of like life-changing, groundbreaking, big aha insight moment. And it was amazing. And I can't stop talking about your podcast to everyone who's like, you know, having maybe PCOS, maybe not, but just, you know, issues about food or anything, because there's so much information there. Like women without PCOS should listen to your podcast. Men without PCOS should listen to your podcast, because it's just so interesting and so much information there. And you have this kind of gift that you use this like scientifically proven and backed information while being empathetic and while being zero, like, patronizing or like condescending, which you so often experience in a field where, you know, someone's like a specialist and tries to explain the field of expertise to an audience who might not know much about it. So you really have a gift for that, and I'm internally grateful for what you do. And after finding the podcast, I was like, right, I'm gonna join the protocol, which I did, and again, huge benefits. Really can't thank you enough for anything that you like. You make it so accessible and understandable, and I really love the logic behind it, that it was how you like do your type identification first, and then you work with the life changes or the lifestyle adaptations that are applicable to your type, and everything just makes so much sense, and everything's again understandable, accessible. And I mean I had challenges with some of the things, like, for example, implementing exercise in my daily routine. Other things like food changes were not a big issue at all. And it helped me a lot. And I think that's actually put my body in the situation where I am now, that because I'm pregnant again, and I'm 16 weeks so far, so it all looks good, knock on wood. And I had a round of letrozole to get there, kind of to stimulate the ovulation, but I think I wouldn't have been able to get where I am now without the protocol, without you, without the knowledge that we received through the protocol and the changes that are implemented through it.
I'm so glad to hear that, and thank you so much. But I also think that's a really important thing for women to realize, is that you do not have to be sort of this all medical or all natural, right? Like sometimes it's actually the best thing is to use both. And it is by no means any kind of failure to use medical fertility treatments like letrozole or like IVF, or it doesn't mean that any lifestyle change has been a failure because it hasn't led you to get that. It's just, well, actually my timing was we were ready. We talked to a specialist and we were actually like, okay, we're ready now to, you know, try and conceive again. And that was the best option for us at this very moment. And so I think that's actually really great for other women to hear this, is that there is no failure, or there is no, that, oh, well, you know, I did all these changes and I still didn't get pregnant naturally, I had to use letrozole. That's not a failure. That's actually great, because what we did was we, you know, helped you feel good. Because imagine going through a pregnancy like feeling like you did previously, where yes, you're, you know, like so fatigued, you know, and because you've experienced now the, you know, in pregnancy we were talking about before, your second trimester, and you're like, man, I'm actually feeling really fatigued again, haven't felt like this for a while. And so imagine if, you know, if we'd started at the level of fatigue you were even, you know, prior to that, it just would have been, and that's the thing, is that not enough care is taken for women postpartum.
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, we want to make sure that you go into pregnancy in the best state possible, so that we can manage postpartum.
Which I definitely was and am, because of the protocol and everything that I learned through it. And I didn't mention that before. I just remembered that actually when I started the protocol, I haven't had my period in I think over 2 years or almost 2 years, because you know, of the being pregnant, breastfeeding, but also, you know, even after my son turned one, I still was breastfeeding. There still was no period, even though I wasn't breastfeeding a lot. I start the period 2-3 weeks and I get my, I start the protocol 2-3 weeks and I get my period. And I was just like, oh my God. Even my partner was like, oh my God, what has she done? She's amazing talking about you, you know? And, and this is when we started, you know, again about having, having a second child. And my only reason to go to a also like seeking specialist help was because I was already 39 or I think 38 back then. I was like, right, when we want to have a child, a second child, we should really, you know, try and do this. Or it was like my personal thing that I wanted to have a child before I turned 40, just because of, you know, probable risks that might be connected to that, even though, you know, there's lots of talk that that probably is not such a high risk involved, if even if you're like a bit old. So that was really the only reason why we said, let's not wait such a long time. Before, back in Dublin, it was like, I think a total, it was more like between four, like I think around 4 years from the time where we really started trying to have a baby until we had the baby, and until it took ages until we went to the fertility clinic, until I went to Prague to do this IVF treatment. So it, and now we were like, right, we have the means now, it's a better option now, let's do it now before, you know. And don't wait so long. But as I said before, I'm very convinced that if I wouldn't have been in such a good place through, like, because of the protocol, like in a physical and also mental way, like it probably wouldn't have, you know, worked the first time. And I'm very, very grateful for that. And I think the protocol helped me to set my body up in a very good and healthy space to.
Tell everyone a little bit about what you, your type. So what do you now know is actually really driving those symptoms?
Because I'm insulin resistant and I also have a thyroid issue. So that is type.
I'm just thinking that it's really interesting for people to understand. It's like, okay, now I can see the connection to, okay, with your insulin resistance and your blood sugar levels is why you were feeling, you know, your energy levels were so low and why you were just really collapsing after eating, you know, why now we can see back at university why you weren't able to go out drinking after dinner because you needed to go to bed because your blood sugar was crashing. And and I think once we understand these things, it makes things so much easier, right? We can put the piece of the puzzle together and then we know what we need to do going forward. There's no like jumping from different, you know, you were saying you're jumping from different diets to diets, from vegetarian to vegan to pescatarian to plant-based to, you know, that it's now it's like, okay, I know what works for my body because I know what's actually why these I'm getting these symptoms and how I can feel it better. So I think that that's where really what I want you to achieve and what I want anybody to achieve is just that bit of clear mental space, not have to be thinking about this all the time. And of course, then, you know, to improve those symptoms. So is there anything that you would like to just final thoughts to kind of pass on to people that you would, if you were you, maybe, you know, going back a few years, what advice would you give to your former self?
Yes, I was thinking about that. I think in hindsight, I would tell myself that don't be so hard on yourself. Don't expect yourself to work in a, you know, in this like kind of perfect way. I think my main takeaway is that I just cannot take it for granted, you know, to wake up in the morning and be like full of energy and say yes to my life, and you know, like my friends seem to be. So I had to learn that I have to do something to be in a good place. Yes. And these things can be like a daily routine or can be exercise or can be whatever, like change of nutrition. So make them your friends. Make PCOS maybe not your friend, but make it, don't make it your enemy. make it a some sort of like companion that's sometimes annoying, but sometimes just there in the background. And what was really important for me, and I think I would tell that my younger self as well, is that you had to practice forgiveness and moving away from this hard attitude towards oneself and cultivating a much warmer and more understanding and more empathetic way of communicating with yourself. That was very important for me. And practice self-care, self-love, self-awareness, all these things that, you know, we also teach in yoga, but I think every human being can benefit from that. And what I really loved also about the protocol is how you emphasize always the 80-20 approach. Because, you know, growing up in Germany, German people, sorry if that sounds very, if that's
stereotypical, but yes. You're right, you're perfectionists.
Yeah, like it's very 100% approach. Like yeah. People would be like, I remember there was a situation where I think some government institutions wanted to implement like a meat-free day during the week in like, you know, government canteens and stuff. And everyone was just like, no, we can't do that. And so they always think in like 0 or 100%, like it's very strict and very, yeah, and I don't think it's very healthy. So the 80-20 approach is much better. Keep your balance. If you feel like pizza, have a pizza, but then, you know, try and give your body a break from that pizza afterwards. And
and the same thing when you're pregnant and you're nauseous and it's just like, cool, so yeah, I will not be eating any protein. I will be only eating potatoes and bananas.
And 2-minute noodles.
2-minute noodles. And it's like, cool. Well, you know what? I would rather that than you starve, right? And that is absolutely my approach. And it's just like, there is a lot of things that we can control and we can focus on, but there's also some that we just like, you know what, we'll just let that happen because it's what, you know what, 8-12 weeks of your life, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. So,
I think it's a really good reminder.
In general, practice and balance is very important. And I think when we talk about PCOS, it's a lot of talk about physical symptoms, about them, the medical background, but it's also important to talk about mental health and how people actually feel being in the struggle of not being diagnosed yet and then being diagnosed and what to do with that, dealing with infertility, all these things. They have a huge impact on your mental health. So I think it's very important that we talk about that as well and that each one of us finds maybe a little way how to deal with it in a healthier way. Like for me, for example, personally, I found, of course, yoga was a way how to find a warmer approach to myself, a nicer one, more empathetic one. But what I really wanted to mention as well was something that really helped me and it's apparently really good for people that struggle with anything, is cold water swims. And really good for your mental health. And it's scientifically proven that it helps with, you know, anxiety, depression, and it reduces your stress levels, it reduces inflammation. There is lots of scientific research going into cold water swimming. And you don't have to, you know, like go into ice cold water and swim 10 kilometers. It's really just a cold dip now and then.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. And it helped, like in Ireland, I developed this habit for me and I cannot stop talking about it because it's one of the best things that I added to, you know, my life. And I cannot recommend it enough to anyone who is maybe struggling with, you know, stress or confusion, self-doubts, all these things. It's one of the best things you can do and one of the cheapest and easiest things you can do as well.
Absolutely. And very much like Wim Hof is a really big advocate for this and his book's really fantastic.
Yes.
I also love it. You'd be happy to know, Charlotte, that I have swum every morning this week. I'm a very, very big proponent of that as well. So thank you so much for all of your time and sharing your story. I love what you said before, make PCOS your companion, right? If we fight this, and yeah, your companion might sometimes be really annoying. And that's the thing, though, is that we know, you know, if it's a companion, what are you going to do? Are you going to turn around and, like, be mean to it? No, like, if it's your friend, you're just going to, like, be empathetic and you're going to, you know, help them through that. It's a really big thing to be understanding and work with your body rather than fighting it the whole time.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for all of your wise words.
Well, thanks for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
That's all today. Thanks so much for listening in to Charlotte's story. If you want to know more information about the PCOS protocol, then this is our 12-week program where we help in the first week to identify your root cause, what's likely driving your hormonal imbalance, and then we help you implement the most specific changes that are going to actually help with that. So we're not here to completely rip out everything fun in your life. We just want to tweak a few things to, you know, for example, if you're like Charlotte and your stress hormones are high and your insulin's a bit high, then we're going to make some tweaks to improve those so that then your hormones can get better and then hopefully your symptoms get better. So that's what we do in there. And it's all very specific to you. So based on what we identify in the first week as what's driving this for you. And then every week we have a Zoom call. So this is a group Zoom call, but you and I talk one-on-one on that if you want to. Just to nut out anything particular to your circumstance. So for example, this week, I'm just thinking we had someone who was an elite athlete, another person who was, well, they were just trying to conceive and they were just wanting to go through everything that they'd tried and figure out what might be going wrong. From there, we could identify that she just didn't know when she was ovulating. Ovulation predictor kits were being used and they are completely inaccurate in PCOS. So we now know that she is ovulating, but ovulating too late in her cycle, and that's what we need to fix. Another one, we looked at her partner's sperm analysis that had been told it was normal, and I could identify that it was not optimal. Another was a woman who was just struggling to make a change. We were trying to change her lunch. She was used to having a very specific type of lunch, and the guidelines, she couldn't figure out how they would fit into what she actually liked to eat. So we talked through what she liked to eat, and we just modified that to be better for her insulin based on what she was already eating and what she already liked, so that she wasn't having to completely overhaul everything. Because the problem is if it's things that you don't like, you're unlikely to stick with it. And there's no point in changing habits, whether that's how much sleep you're getting or how much what you're eating, for just a few weeks. This needs to be a change for a long period of time. It needs to be sustainable. So that's what we really focus on as well, is making sure that changes can be sustainable. So if you want to know more about that, then head to thepcosnutritionist.com and then hit programs from the main menu and drop down and you'll see the PCOS protocol there. We'll also put a link in the show notes below. And if you have any questions about the PCOS protocol and you want more information, then please don't hesitate to email us at hello@thepcosnutritionist.com. That's all for today. See you next week. Stand by for the medical disclaimer.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.